for 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware. I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on February 23rd, 2019, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel joins me to discuss various Democratic Party healthcare proposals and what does or does not constitute Medicare for All. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho this week is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Nate was not able to make it this week, but we're going to be talking about some of the competing healthcare proposals coming from various Democrats, some running for president, some not. There's a whole bunch of different plans that have been like talked about in the news and so forth, and I think it's important to understand what they are and are not, because there's going to be basically a big debate within the party over the next over the coming 2+ years on what, when Democrats hopefully have control of the various branches of government again, what they want to do on the healthcare issue. Of course, single-payer healthcare had long been a goal for many years of the Democratic Party before it was sort of put on the back burner as a different wing of the party took power. But, you know, going back to like the Truman years, that was sort of a big thing for a lot of Democrats. Of course, there are various models for covering everyone on a healthcare system in other countries. And so that gets brought up as well of like, well, what if we did it this way or what if we did it that way? But again, we have to talk about what would work for the United States and also what is being discussed. And I think we've been pretty clear on this show that we're in favor of not accepting anything less than a single plan that's covering everyone. You need to decomplexify, demystify the entire process, reduce the paperwork, reduce the cost by unifying everything and so forth, and that would be the better way to go with that. But not everyone agrees, even within the party, and there's certainly a lot of countervailing lobbying going on, so we need to talk about that as well. So Rachel, where do we want to start on this? Which plan do we want to talk about here?
So I think we should start at like one of the first plans that got floated out. Senator Sherrod Brown kind of wanted to lower the eligibility age for retiring police and firefighters. He wanted to give them access to Medicare before 65. This was kind of baffling to a lot of people. It's kind of weird to create a pool of people that is so kind of specialized and leave other people out. There was a Splinter News article about this, and they said giving cops and firefighters health care is fine, just as it would be great to give teachers or nurses or public sanitation workers health care, but it's in no way an alternative to Medicare for All, and it sure is a weird way to approach the problem of the financial barriers to adequate health care, expanding access one job at a time in order of how noble Sherrod Brown deems your job to be. Yeah, it's kind of weird to just kind of like break people up by their occupation.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can think that which they also didn't say in defense of this, you know, people were joking this was the Medicare for All cops plan, but like, I guess the effect that this specifically would have, although again, you have to ask the same exact question with regard to teachers, is, you know, that having firefighters, having police officers, et cetera, on a federal plan would relieve an enormous amount of costs from local municipalities, counties, and cities across the country. But again, right, they didn't say that. That wasn't the case they were making. There didn't seem to be a case, as far as I could tell, other than, oh, people like police and firefighters. And I mean, it's like the let's support the troops of like municipal government, basically. And that seemed to be the argument that they were making. And as you said, you can't just start breaking apart like and picking and choosing specific occupations. I mean, with a few exceptions, right? Like there's been special bills for like 9/11 first responders because of all the asbestos that they inhaled and the cancerous effects that that had. But again, those are specific reasons. And that was not the case that was being made here. There didn't seem to be a case. You know, he kind of went in a broader direction, which was toward a buy-in plan for anyone under 50. And I know you're going to talk a little bit about that. But like, just again, the big problem here, which still applies when you're talking about buying in at 50, you know, in the 50 to 65 range, as opposed to just for firefighters or whatever, is when you break down a coalition like that, when you or break apart a coalition like that by giving some of them some stuff, that's not actually making progress in the right direction. That's not what we call a step in the right direction. That's actually making it worse. And the reason for that is that you are making it harder to get the thing you actually want, because fewer people will have a vested interest in all coming together and uniting to fight for the next step after that. If you're designing a compromise, like if you first, you know, let's say it's not unreasonable, you can't get the votes in Congress after no amount of fighting is going to get you the votes on some specific all-encompassing proposal, whether it's healthcare or some other issue. And you say, okay, well, what can we get done? Well, what you don't want to do is introduce a plan on the issue that's going to cover, that's going to give everything you want to some people. What you want to do instead is give some stuff to everyone. And that's the opposite of what you're doing with something like a Medicare buy-in at 50 or everyone going in to Medicare at 50, if that's a plan, because the result of that is similar to what happened with the Medicare itself, you know, the original version of that, which is that now you've taken those people. I mean, yes, you've helped those people, which is great, but you have now removed them from the political coalition agitating for something larger. I mean, it's a similar issue on environmental things as well, but, you know, healthcare, it's more easy to visualize there, which is like, if you were not able to get a fully comprehensive healthcare plan for everyone in the country, it is better to introduce a healthcare plan or some healthcare legislation affecting one specific thing. Maybe it's something involving prescription drugs or some other specific element of the healthcare challenge. Maybe even just like universal dental care for everyone, right? That's like a specific element, as opposed to saying this is only for these people in this age bracket or this demographic or this occupation. What you want to do is give something to everyone, because that's actual progress forward that is benefiting everyone. It's not leaving people behind. It's not breaking up your political coalition. That's going to give you a stronger chance of getting something through in the end. And of course, we are not endorsing partial plans either. We're saying go all the way this time and have that fight. But if you were to come up with a compromise, you would want it to be in that direction. But you know, as you were going to talk about, Rachel, there's a lot of different slightly different proposals being raised here, which is very confusing. So talk about what Sherrod Brown ended up gravitating to after the police and firefighters thing.
So Senators Debbie Stabenow of Michigan and Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin are pushing a Medicare buy-in at 50. Again, incremental change to expand health coverage. Yeah, like we've said before, incremental change is just too slow, and it's compromising from a weakened position. There's a quote, I found an article on this in Politico, and Senator Baldwin said, "I have always supported universal health care, but we are not there yet. Medicare at 50 is a very bold step in the right direction." I don't think she's qualified to say what's bold or not. And the fact that she's saying she's always supported universal health care, but quote unquote, we're not there yet, It just shows that she likes to think about the concept in the abstract, but doesn't seem to like it in reality, because if she did like it in reality, she'd be pushing for it.
Well, it's like how a lot of people after the 2016 or during the 2016 election became very openly resentful of the fact that they discovered there were people in the Democratic Party who were to their left, mm-hmm. like that their whole like self-conceptualization, which I think is maybe true of Tammy Baldwin as a senator for Wisconsin, is like being the most acceptably liberal you can be permissibly, right? Like, because she tries to be kind of centristy and so forth. And the notion that the ground has changed or the political landscape has changed or the base of the party has changed, like that doesn't register with them. Or if it does, they're like upset about it. And I'm not saying that's exactly what's happening here, but I think it comes from a similar place of like, well, I like to think of myself as someone who supports universal health care, but now I've made it all the way to the United States Senate in my career, and now confronted with the actual chance to support universal health care, which I claim to have supported for my whole career, well, now I'm going to walk away from that and say, oh, actually, we can't do it.
Right. And there's a quote from the executive director of National Nurses United, Bonnie Castillo. She said, the opposition, the insurance companies and pharma, they will come out against anything, whether it's a half measure or even a one quarter measure. That's why we have to aim high. And to prove her point, there was a quote from the Federation of American Hospitals, the president and CEO, Chip Kahn. Expanding the program with hospitals facing the lowest Medicare margins in history will make it more difficult to provide the critical care that all Americans expect and deserve. So they're already pushing back on this really just like hollow gesture of expanding Medicare or expanding healthcare for more Americans.
Right.
So,
and again, you know, as you said, we're not even talking at this point about Medicare for all. We're talking about just, you know, something like just expanding it to 50, which, by the way, not to derail there either, but also like plenty of people have pointed out that if you wanted to expand it by age demographic, you would start with children and people up to age 26 and put them on Medicare. They're much healthier and lower cost to treat. You wouldn't continue to expand it down from the top. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and that's not really beneficial politically to the party. But, you know, Libby Watson had this great roundup of these quotes on some of, again, we're talking about these partial plans, these expansionist plans that are far short of Medicare for all. And she pulled together all these quotes. So Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which she describes as a lobbying group formed specifically to fight single payer proposals. Quote, whether you call it Medicare for all, Medicare buy-in, single payer, or a public option, it moves us toward a one-size-fits-all healthcare system that is wrong for America, which is basically like the rhetoric that the same industries used almost verbatim in the 1960s when fighting the creation of the original Medicare. There's another quote, the lobbying group America's Health Insurance Plans. This is a slippery slope to government-run healthcare for every American. The American people want healthcare that works, not a one-size-fits-all healthcare system. I mean, that could be practically from those Reagan speeches against health, universal healthcare that he was paid to do by General Electric. Like, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s, there was this push for government healthcare. The compromise ended up being Medicare, and they would always say, this is a slippery slope to government-run healthcare for every American, and it's one size fits all, and it's not appropriate, and it's vaguely communist, and so forth. And Libby Watson, her commentary in that Splinter article is, what does this tell you? It tells you that these groups do not want any change at all and will fight hard to oppose any plan, including a public option. And she mentions that specifically because there are still people who are saying, well, everything with the ACA and the Obamacare would have been fine if we'd gotten the public option, and we just need to tinker a little bit. We just need to add that public option, which, you know, Medicare for All campaigners is saying is nowhere near sufficient. It's just not, I mean, that's nonsense. Like, that's, you stop having a conversation from 10 years ago. We got to move on at this point. Libby says, it tells you that they apparently do not distinguish in their messaging between single payer plans that would cover everyone and include dental, vision, and drug care, as opposed to weak public option plans that would likely cost almost as much as private insurance for the consumer, which does not bode well for any Democrat who thinks that sneaking through a public option in 2021 is a viable path to reform. So the point here that she's making, which is a point that we've made on this show before, is the other reason that you don't want to do some half measure compromise thing is that the amount of political effort that you need to expend to get the half measure through is the same as the political effort that it requires to get an actual comprehensive measure through. And I know that some people just say that's not true. I'm sorry, it is. They're going to fight it with the exact same rhetoric and the exact same intensity, even if it's a minor expansion or a mid-sized expansion, as they are if it's the whole shebang. You have to take that into consideration, and then you balance that out and say, well, which one would be better for our country? Which one would be better for our economic system? Which one would be better for the public as a whole? The answer is to go in the whole shebang direction and not go for these half measures. They're much more expensive. They don't get the job done. And it's, again, going to be that heavy lift. Also, we've seen with things like the ACA, the more sort of paperwork and means testing you add on this, the harder it makes people's lives, and the more they resent it and don't see it as the, you know, you helping them with your political agenda. If you want to get reelected, you need to pass things that are simple to understand and clearly benefit people and don't add hassle to their lives. That's the reality of it. And if you're going to have to go and have this huge Herculean fight against these industries and these lobbies, you want to have that for something that's actually going to get the job done.
Right. And I wanted to point out that there's a Vox article that kind of has an explainer for all of these most of the bills being proposed currently. And it has a really good chart explaining like the logistics of it as well. So they discuss Sanders' Medicare for All bill, Representative Jayapal's Medicare for All bill. I think it's been co-signed by many members of the House Progressive Caucus, the Center for American Progress, the think tank's Medicare Extra for All, Senator Merkley and Murphy's Medicare buy-in bill, Schakowsky and White House's Medicare buy-in bill, Bennett, Higgins, and Kane's Medicare buy-in bill, Schatz and Lujan's Medicaid buy-in bill, and another think tank, the Urban Institute's Healthy America proposal. And it breaks down the plans by, do all Americans get gain coverage, which not all of them do. Do Americans still get insurance at work? Most of these plans still involve employer-provided insurance, except for Sanders and Jayapal's bills. Do public plan enrollees pay premiums? Again, all of the bills, except for Sanders and Jayapal's bills, require that. Does it require a tax increase? I know this is contentious with a lot of people. Sanders, Jayapal's, and then the two think tank bills do say that they require a tax increase to pay for it. And then all of the plans has the government regulate healthcare prices. So I think just looking at that chart, the fact that not all Americans gain coverage for most of these bills, a lot of them were Medicare and Medicaid buy-in bills. Like you said, like we should just reject them on their face because they are not helping all Americans gain coverage instantly. It's these half measures, these quarter measures. And a lot of them are still married to this idea of employer-provided insurance, which is stupid. Like, nobody actually enjoys their employer-provided insurance.
Other than the alternative of having nothing. Like, they're afraid of losing their insurance and having nothing. But if you're like, right, you can have the employer-based insurance, or you can have this great insurance that everyone's going to have, and it's guaranteed, mm-hmm, most people, there's obviously a few people who have extremely high-end, very cushy employer-based plans. Those are extremely minority of people, and we have to make a decision that is benefiting the country as a whole and the public as a whole. Most people, the other thing is they tend to like their employer-based plan until they have to actually use it for something significant.
Right.
Like somebody gets cancer, or they get hit by a car or something like that. There's some major medical expense. All of a sudden they find out that this plan that they've had for a long time that they thought was pretty good doesn't really do the things they thought it did.
Right. And I know a lot of the insurance company like spokespeople were saying like, they were bringing up the specter of one size fits all healthcare. But if you ever have tried to navigate the hoops of the private insurance industry and your employer provided coverage, you quickly learn that what your plan covers isn't always what you need, and what you need isn't always covered by the plan. So you're being twisted into drugs that like are maybe generics or maybe an older version of a drug that might not help you as well as the recommended drug, or your insurance isn't covering procedures that would help you get a diagnosis or help pinpoint the cause of your symptoms. Or then you discover that your prescription coverage isn't great. Your dental coverage isn't great. I know mine is not great at all. Vision is often really poorly covered as well. So the fact that people are trying to tout that employer-provided insurance is so great is just, you've obviously have never had to navigate the system and seen the constraints that are forced upon you. So a one-size-fits-all healthcare plan that is comprehensive and free at the point of service would definitely be much, much more preferable than trying to navigate this weird labyrinth of healthcare in this country as it is now. And another really important thing for me is, do public plan enrollees pay premiums? And Sanders and Jayapal are saying, no, like everybody's going to be covered through taxes, so you don't need to actually pay any extra in premiums. And I think that is huge as well, because I think the fact that our premiums, well, if you have employer provided coverage, you don't get to see the true cost of your premiums because you're paying a percentage and your employer is paying a percentage. So I think it's really easy to kind of downplay how much premiums are costing you. And so unless you actually like scrutinize your pay stub and see how much, by adding together what I pay and what my employer pays, like I could buy an iPhone every month, basically. I think sometimes two iPhones every month. I know people were trying to equate healthcare with iPhones earlier. So it's just really ridiculous to see people deriding young people for not being able to afford insurance or afford healthcare by equating it with consumer goods, when we're trying to kind of hide the true cost of healthcare and how much it costs the person, when it's this kind of piecemeal coverage that's being provided as it is now.
Also, you want to talk about, I mean, the politics of it again, you know, trying to get to those votes that you need to get something passed. Like, I'm sorry, but two of these plans here have both tax increases and premiums that you have to pay. So you're already going to have to do the political fight of getting a bill through that raises taxes. And then on top of that, you're also going to demand that people have to pay premiums as part of this plan. Like, this is these Rube Goldberg wonks that think they're coming up with a better plan or whatever. And it's like, no, it's not only is it a worse plan, but it's politically harder to get through and then politically harder to defend at the ballot box. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. And then one of them, like, is, yeah, the government helps regulate healthcare prices. Americans still get insurance at work. Do public plan enrollees pay premiums? Yes. Does it require a tax increase? Still yes. Do all Americans gain coverage? No. Well, okay, now you haven't accomplished anything. Like, you've picked the worst of all the categories at that point. Like, what are you doing? How is this the solution that these people are coming up with? Anyway, continue on.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that those two plans were the think tank's plans, which I think there's a really good article from Splinter News by Tim Faust, and he kind of spends a lot of time kind of denigrating the wonks. I think he says they're very self-important, but they don't really offer a lot by way of improving people's lives or offering policy solutions that would make people's lives significantly better.
Yeah, he made some kind of quasi-sympathetic comment a couple days ago where he said something like, a lot of these people spent their whole sort of academic careers learning how to like come up with public policy solutions on this issue in a world that assumed that private health insurance not only would continue to exist, but had to continue to exist, and that they can't really think of they can't envision a scenario in which that's not true. And so they're not willing to entertain or develop any, you know, wonky plans that don't involve private insurance.
Well, yeah, I think they should learn about the conditions of the world now and kind of read the room, I guess, and see your wonkery isn't really popular now. And people are envisioning a better world where we don't have to live like this anymore. Tim Faust also breaks down these proposals, and he is looking for four major criteria that he calls the fundamental components of single payer. These are the things that really need to be included in your proposal for them to be acceptable. So he said a single mandatory risk pool. That way, with Medicare right now as it stands, we're putting the most risky people in a pool together and kind of removing them from the equation, which is kind of silly. By including everybody in the pool, we are really diluting the risk. He says right now in the U.S., 50% of healthcare spending comes from 5% of the population. And oftentimes that is like the people that are on Medicare currently, the older people and disabled people. Let's see. And he also says comprehensive coverage. So all care for all people must also mean all care, medical, dental, mental, vision, reproductive, long-term healthcare must be covered. Playing catch up with other countries is not enough. We are capable of and should provide a higher standard of care than any currently existing single-payer program on the globe. So I think we've talked about Canada, we've talked about the UK, and they don't cover a lot of dental and vision currently. And so we can do better. We can't just catch up to them at this point, which I agree with completely. We are the richest country in the world. Like, we obviously have enough to provide this for everyone, and there's really no excuse for not. And then he also mentioned how long-term care is funded right now is just really appalling. I think we've talked about this before. Medicare doesn't cover long-term care, and so the problem is shunted to either private insurance or Medicaid. And oftentimes Medicaid requires you to spend down all your assets before you can get assistance for long-term care. And the protections for people in long-term care facilities just isn't there. I think it's pretty hard to bring malpractice claims against long-term care facilities. And there's a lot of incentive right now to just kind of pack people into long-term care facilities without providing care for them. They receive sweetheart deals from state Medicaid programs and then turn around and slash care budgets, underpay staff, neglect and abuse their patients, and pocket the profit. So if under a public model, at that point, that there isn't that profit motivation, or if they were publicly owned, there would be much more oversight in the care of people in these facilities. And that brings me to point number three, standards, payment, and oversight at the federal level. The federal government must set minimum standards for care and guarantee prices and payment. When states can pick and choose what care they offer, their smaller budgets and inability to deficit spend gives them a financial incentive to cut costs and save money, and people die. And then the fourth point is local implementation and flexibility. He points out healthcare needs in Brooklyn, Boston, Birmingham, and Butte are all different from each other. Keeping the delivery of single-payer funding as close to the ground as possible lets it be more responsive to both the needs of the people and democratic pressure. Let a San Francisco health agency use funds to put people in homes. Let a rural Iowan one spend on transport services to bring people in rural areas to their dialysis appointments. So he points out that the only bills that really cover these are Bernie Sanders and Representative Jayapal's bills. And he actually has some criticism of Bernie's bill. He says it lacks really comprehensive coverage for elder and long-term care. But I think Bernie's bill is good in that it covers all Americans. So I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss it.
Right, and it's something to push on getting added in as well, yeah.
Right. I think Sanders has been really responsive to criticism, and he hasn't really shied away from moving left if people put pressure on him.
All right. Well, Rachel, thanks for going over all these different plans. Like you said, we're going to be hearing a lot about these different plans in the next couple years or so, and especially from these presidential candidates. And it's important to understand what is and is not Medicare for all, or even anything close, and sort of can't let people kind of weasel out with these measures that don't really get the job done. So thanks for being on, Rachel.
Thanks, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.